This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. America recently lost two civil rights giants in the span of 24 hours. Representative John Lewis and Reverend C.T. Vivian led the way in the 1960s, practicing nonviolence even in the face of angry mobs and beatings by police. They were part of a movement that pushed America forward, one march, freedom ride, and demonstration at a time. Today, that movement lives on in Black Lives Matter.
United will never be defeated, the people. United will never be defeated, the people. United will never be defeated.
We wanted to make space for all of you to remember and honor the lives of those who were on the front lines for change. And we want to talk about where the movement for racial justice stands today. For that, we're joined by Bernard Lafayette Jr., longtime civil rights leader and activist. Brittany Packnett Cunningham, activist, educator, and founder of Love and Power. It's a firm focused on justice and equity, and she was a member of President Obama's policing task force. And also with us, Jarell Jordan, a senior political science major at Morehouse College and a former White House ambassador for HBCUs. Everyone, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So John Lewis was the youngest speaker at the March on Washington with Martin Luther King Jr., and until his death last Friday, he was the last speaker still alive. Here he is on that day in 1963.
Those who have said be patient and wait, we must say that we cannot be patient. We do not want our freedom gradually, but we want to be free now. We are tired of being beaten by policemen. We are tired of seeing our people locked up in jail over and over again. And then you holler, be patient. How long can we be patient? We want our freedom and we want it now.
Brittany, to have them both pass on the same day, it is a big blow. How did you handle that news?
It was a big blow. There were many, many tears. But, you know, as a person of faith, as both Mr. Lewis and Reverend Vivian were, I recognized it as a moment that did not come to us by accident. I really feel like the creator, the universe, God, whatever it is you call this force that is bigger than all of us, was reminding us of our collective responsibility in this moment. I've sat with Reverend Vivian and Mr. Lewis in particular at a multi-generational civil rights meeting during the Obama administration, the likes of which had never happened before. And tears filled both of their eyes, in part because they saw their legacy living on. So there is something comforting, especially in my faith tradition, about recognizing that they felt free to finally be at rest because their work was continuing and they could pass the torch, and that there are thousands, if not millions of people, not just in America, but around the world, who are bearing that torch every single day. But it was also a reminder to those of us who have chosen this work that, as the old folks say, we can't rely on our parents' religion and we can't rely on somebody else's freedom work. Mm-hmm. That we have to engage in the study and the discipline and the practice it will continuously take to make sure that we are lifting up this mantle, because we cannot rely on the work and the labor of past generations. We have to make sure that we are consistently stepping up to the plate. So many people are, and that's exactly what we have to keep doing.
Jarell, what about for you?
I think this moment was, it was very disheartening to see, just knowing Congressman Lewis and the stories that he told, the life that he lived. For me as a young person, it was a sad day. It was a sad day to lose both of them in the same day, and also see that the same thing that he lived for, he died fighting for. And it's something that I believe that we as a generation and we as a nation should continue so that their life's work is not in vain.
Bernard, you knew both Congressman John Lewis and Reverend C.T. Vivian. I would imagine this was a loss you felt very acutely.
Yes, I am still struggling with it. It's just such a shocking thing for both of them to die within a 24-hour period after all the years they've worked together. And I knew them in Nashville from the very beginning of my involvement in the movement and that sort of thing. So, yes, it is. It's still something that I'm, you know, struggling to think about. And then we keep hearing about people who pass it on. Medgar Evers' brother, Charles Evers, just died yesterday. So they're going one by one, but close together.
You know, many people were familiar with Congressman John Lewis, but maybe less familiar with Reverend C.T. Vivian. Bernard, can you tell us more about what he stood for and what he was passionate about?
You mean C.T. Vivian?
Yes, sir.
Oh, yes. Well, he was a little bit older than we were, quite a bit, but he was right along with us. And so he did a lot of coaching for us, because he'd gone through a lot of the things that we were, as young college students, going through. And we learned so much, you know, from him. He was a constant teacher. In fact, he was my homiletics teacher, because he was the assistant to the homiletics teacher there at American Baptist College in Nashville. So it ended up that we were cellmates on the Freedom Rides in Jackson, Mississippi. So here, you thought you had left your classes, and here you've got your professor as your cellmate. So we never stopped learning, and so that was just really remarkable. So CT was right there with us, but he didn't try to be the spokesman per se. Where it was necessary, he did, but he encouraged us quite a bit.
Well, CT Vivian was hopeful for the next generation, and here he is giving a message to today's young people.
It's up to us to create the world we really want. We have to say it. We have to sing it. We have to do it, because that's the only way we can really find out what the world will be like. The world we want to create, our generations that have come before us have desired it. We're the first that can really have it. We're the first that can make it a reality. We've lived and waited for you to come along, and because the conditions are right for you to win.
Jarrell, you're just really beginning your political career. When you hear that admonition from C.T. Vivian, how does it make you think about the way you're approaching your work?
It just really... It pushes me and it motivates me to continue to carry the mantle that they have left. And it provokes me to work with people of my age, people of my generation, to continue that work, to start new organizations, just to continue their legacy.
We got this message from a member of our text club. It reads, among the many things that should be done to honor these two brave leaders is their contribution to our society should be in every elementary school history and high school civics textbook. Still to come, more on the legacy of Congressman John Lewis and Reverend C.T. Vivian with Bernard Lafayette Jr., Brittany Packnett Cunningham, and Jarrell Jordan. I'm Jen White. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, BetterHelp, the online counseling service dedicated to connecting you with a licensed counselor to help you overcome whatever stands in the way of your happiness. Fill out a questionnaire and get matched with a professional tailored to your needs. And if you aren't satisfied with your counselor, you can request a new one at any time, free of charge. Visit BetterHelp.com/1A to get 10% off your first month. Get the help you deserve with BetterHelp.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or maybe perfect strangers? You can get all the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
A Minneapolis business owner's daughter is called out publicly for racist, anti-Black tweets. Fighting to save his business and trying to make amends, he calls on a prominent Black Muslim leader for help. He's an Arab Muslim.
And I said, Brother Makram, I'm here to learn. Tell me what to do.
To hear what happens next, listen to Code Switch from NPR.
I'm Jen White. Today we're remembering two civil rights titans, Congressman John Lewis and Reverend C.T. Vivian. Both died last Friday after spending their lifetimes fighting for change. And today is the funeral for C.T. Vivian for friends and family in Georgia. But we're looking ahead, too, sharing your thoughts and ideas about how we best honor their legacies. I'm here with Bernard Lafayette, Jr., longtime civil rights leader and activist, Brittany Packnett Cunningham, activist, educator, and founder of Love and Power. It's a firm focused on justice and equity. And also with us, Jarrell Jordan. He's a senior political science major at Morehouse College. Brittany, you know, I wonder, when someone achieves that icon label, some of the nuance, the pain, gets lost in the retelling. Do you worry about that for these two men?
I worry greatly, but now is the time for us to make sure that we are course correcting before it deeply becomes a problem. Jamil K. Smith wrote about both of these icons for Rolling Stone magazine, and he really challenged us to make sure that our remembrances are about more than just sweet moments, but that we are actually correctly and accurately convicting the country that continuously let these men down, given their immense sacrifice that has yet to be fully answered for, not just in American systems and culture, but truly in American policy. Everyone wants to focus on the good part of John Lewis's good trouble. Nobody wants to talk about the trouble that both he and Reverend Vivian and so many of their peers like Reverend Lafayette found themselves in because they were deeply and intentionally countercultural. So what does that mean we have to replicate in this moment? It means that we have to make sure that we do not allow people like Mitch McConnell to stand up sweet remembrances of John Lewis when, in fact, he has stood in the way of restoring the Voting Rights Act in the honor of John Lewis that was destructed and stripped in by the Supreme Court in 2013. He has stood in the way of that bill passing in the Senate. It means that we have to make sure that Brian Kemp, who leveraged the very voter suppression tactics that John Lewis and C.T. Vivian bled for to fight against, does not just stand up a nice tweet about John Lewis, but that he actually has to be held to account for the ways in which he leveraged those voter suppression tactics to sit in the office of governor in John Lewis's home state that he's sitting in right now. It means that we have to make sure that we hold on tight to the truth of history, just as your texter said, to make sure that we don't years later have to reclaim the legacies of C.T. Vivian and John Lewis in the same way we're having to do with Dr. Martin Luther King right now. We have to recognize that good trouble still requires trouble, and it means standing in the way intentionally of a status quo that continues to benefit certain people and continues to oppress the rest of us.
Well, Tom from Rockport, West Virginia, emailed us saying if Republican lawmakers want to honor Lewis, then they should pass voting rights legislation already passed by the House and stop their empty platitudes of sympathy. Well, C.T. Vivian notably stood up to a sheriff who was blocking Black Americans from registering to vote in Selma. And Vivian was punched in the face so hard that it broke the sheriff's hand. But through this, he still stood for nonviolent action. And here he is talking to Democracy Now! In 2015.
What we have to see beyond all things, that Martin King, right, was our leader. What we have and what was given to us from its very beginnings is an understanding that we could not win by killing. Light doesn't come because of darkness, all right? We are here to change America and always have been.
Bernard, you studied nonviolence and were part of some of the training courses on the subject in Nashville. Can you tell us about what you learned and how you all defined nonviolence?
Yes, it was a special situation because we had people there who embraced Martin Luther King's approach in the Montgomery bus boycott and also had their own experience. C.T. had been involved in nonviolence even before Nashville. But we had Jim Lawson, who had studied nonviolence in India. And Martin Luther King asked him to come south. And he came to Nashville and enrolled at graduate school at Vanderbilt University. So one of the things in terms of nonviolence is you have to always make sure that the steps that you're taking leads to the goal that you're trying to reach. In other words, if you want a peaceful, loving, reconciling community, you can't get that by retaliating with violence. In fact, every move you make, you must exemplify that goal that you're trying to reach. That's one of the things. The other is that, and it's much more difficult, but you have to withdraw your support from an evil system. And that way you have to identify the power in the situation that you're in. Martin Luther King's definition for power was very simple, although he was very articulate and multisyllables in his speaking and that kind of thing. His definition of power was one, is very simple: the ability to either supply or withdraw needed resources. And that's where we had our economic withdrawal. Okay? Mm-hmm. And so we have to identify in every situation, where is the power? What do we contribute to the situation? Now, as black people, we were going along with segregation all those years. So we contributed to it. So all we had to do is make the things change is, you know, like the bus boycott in Montgomery, withdraw our financial support to the bus company. Okay? So you have to look at in what ways are we contributing to the system, because we're part of it. Can't be a system unless all parts are cooperating.
Jarrell, I want to come to you because I think we've all seen a lot of conversations about nonviolence as a protest tactic in recent months. And what are the conversations you're having with your contemporaries about nonviolence?
So the conversations that we're having, we're seeing from Atlanta, even here to Birmingham, where we have marches, we have demonstrations, we have protests that are centered around nonviolence, and then they make a turn and there's some type of uproar, there's some type of damage, and we don't want that to excuse what we're trying to do. We're trying to accomplish something, and that type of action can make it seem like we're not legitimate and we're not serious about what we're trying to do. So my generation, we're having conversations about how can we work with our local elected officials, our state elected officials, and even on the federal level to get some type of legislation passed and to just do things in our community. One thing at a time, whether that's working with our neighbors to get them registered to vote on our block, whether that's starting organizations, whether that's even going into schools and getting young people to vote. It's those small steps that we have to continue to make sure that this work is completed.
We had one listener call in who didn't want to be identified. She was part of the marches in the 60s, and she says people regularly police the people around them to make sure no one threw anything or did anything that could be considered a violent act. And she says she's disturbed by the way people are not keeping each other in line the same way today. That was her perspective. Bernard, when you hear or when you speak to young activists today, what are the major ideas or lessons you try to leave them with?
Well, first of all, I want them to understand that in order to bring about change, it's important to win over the majority, if not the active support, the sympathy of the majority. It was Napoleon who said no revolution has ever been won unless you're able to win the sympathy and active support of the majority. So we have to look at the total community, not just one segment, and look at what is best for all of us. So I think the earlier point that was made is that we always have to have marshals in our marches. And that's the thing that really makes a difference and helps. Like, for example, a lot of the marshals in these demonstrations we had with students were actually trained as marshals. It's little known, for example, that some of the marshals on the Selma March itself, after it got started, you know, down the road, leaving, you know, Selma going to Montgomery, some of those marshals were actually gang members from South Side Chicago, the Vice Lords. The picture that you see in the museums with the young fella with this black tam on, turned backwards on his head, carrying the American flag with Mrs. King and Dr. King and Mrs. Abernathy and Abernathy walking behind the American flag with this fella carrying. That fella is Lamar McCoy. I trained him in Chicago. Okay.
We're going to pick up this conversation in just a moment. We heard from Beth in Tacoma Park in Maryland, who says, we were lucky enough to meet Mr. Lafayette last year while visiting Montgomery. He and his wife came to the Freedom Rides Museum to talk to a group of young teachers, and we were invited to sit in with them. By the end, he had us all singing freedom songs that they had sung in jail. It was a precious memory that I will never forget. Thank you for all that you continue to do. We're talking about the legacy of two civil rights icons and who's ready to carry the fight forward. I'm Jen White. We'll hear much more from you and our guests in just a moment.
We're only months away from Election Day, and every week, or even every few hours, there's a new twist that could affect who will win the White House. To keep up with the latest, tune in to the NPR Politics Podcast every day to find out what happened and what it means for the election.
We're remembering the lives of two civil rights giants and talking about what their legacy means for the next generation of activists. I'm here with Bernard Lafayette Jr., longtime civil rights leader and activist, Brittany Packnett Cunningham, activist, educator, and founder of Love and Power, a firm focused on justice and equality, and a member of President Obama's policing task force. And we have Jarrell Jordan, senior political science major at Morehouse College and former White House ambassador for HBCUs. Back in 2016, John Lewis accepted a National Book Award for the graphic novel March, his autobiographical take on the civil rights movement.
Thank you. Thank you. This is unreal. This is unbelievable. Some of you know I grew up in rural Alabama, very, very poor, very few books in our home. And I remember in 1956, when I was 16 years old, with some of my brothers and sisters and cousins going down to the public library, trying to get library cards. And we were told that the library was for whites only and not for colors. And to come here and receive this award, this honor for this, it's too much. Thank you. But I had a wonderful teacher in elementary school who told me, read, my child, read. And I tried to read everything. I love books.
Reverend Lafayette, we've heard the stories about the march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma to advocate for voting rights. That march resulted in John Lewis having his skull fractured by Alabama state troopers. So you were often in very dangerous situations, being attacked by both police and mobs. How did you get past the fear?
Well, there is always fear, because if you didn't have fear, then you wouldn't be conscious of the danger. So we certainly was very conscious of the danger. And but your courage must overcome your fear. And the way you do that is you constantly think about the end that you're trying to reach. And by focusing on the end that you're trying to reach, it makes you realize that that end that you're trying to reach is possible. So by insisting that you are going to accomplish your goal, regardless of what happened to you, that you're going to set the example for others to follow, no matter what happens to you. So it's not about the individual. It's about those young people that you are hearing from now. We are so excited, and we used to just smile when we see each other, knowing that these young people are taking up the torch. And the black and the white and the Asians and the Native Americans all working together. Now, it's important to keep coalitions. Don't let anything split you apart. And this thing is worldwide. And I'm just glad that I've lived this long to be able to see this happen.
Jarrell, I have to ask you, as the youngest person on our panel, when you hear Reverend Lafayette talk about the joy it brings him to see young activists today, what does it mean for you to be one of those young people who he's describing?
It's exciting to hear and to see young people, not just here in the United States, but across the world, raising the torch and actually taking up this work. I'm reminded of a song, Make Them Hear You by Brian Mitchell, and it states, your sword can be a sermon or the power of the pen. Teach every child to raise his voice, and then my brothers then. And one thing that we have to do is put pressure on our elected officials, on our leaders, and we have to make them do the work. And if they're not willing to do the work, then we have to get in these positions and we have to do the work ourselves. Because if we can write Black Lives Matter on a street and they can come out and they can take pictures and they can take photo ops in front of churches and they can do these other things, then clearly they can put that same energy into legislation so that Black Lives Matter is also on the street, but it's also legal, so that you have to treat us as if our Black Lives Matter. You have to treat us as if our children's life matter. You have to treat us as if our education matters. And we have to, as John Lewis said, redeem the soul of America. Mm.
Well, on the topic of being heard, here's Congressman Lewis speaking on the House floor last year about the Voting Rights Act.
The right to vote is precious, almost sacred. In a democratic society, it is the most powerful, nonviolent instrument or tool that we have. In my heart of hearts, I believe we have a moral responsibility to restore access for all of our citizens who desire to participate in the democratic process. Many people marched, protested for the right to vote. Some gave a little blood, others gave their very lives.
Brittany, there's a push by Democrats to expand the Voting Rights Act in honor of Congressman Lewis. There's also a movement to change the name of the Edmund Pettus Bridge in his honor. What are your thoughts on these moves?
I think they're critically important as we recognize the danger in canonizing figures of Confederate history, segregation, and white supremacy. Certainly, the name of the Edmund Pettus Bridge needs to be changed, and who better than Congressman Lewis to have his name emblazoned there. And at the same time, in our collective grief for losing both of these men and, as Reverend Lafayette said, an entire generation, more and more and more, of people who gave us the very freedoms we enjoy right now, we have to ensure that our grief does not prioritize symbolism over lasting change, the very lasting change that Jarrell is talking about. And that lasting change can come in part by ensuring that Congress passes with a veto-proof majority, the restoration of that Voting Rights Act in both of their names. There is an understanding of what grief does to the body and the mind and the soul that will make us reach for symbolism. But what can happen is that people who have no intention of following through on Reverend Vivian and Mr. Lewis and Reverend Lafayette's legacies, to exploit that desire for symbolism, that desire for comfort, and give us all of the right rhetoric and do none of the right things. So we have to make sure, as Jarrell already said, that we are
putting the pressure on those in power to ensure that they are making real moves and not simply symbolic ones. And we, as Reverend Lafayette said, have to remain disciplined in our focus on nonviolence, disciplined in our clarity of message, disciplined in our fight, and doing the quiet work that it will take to not just pursue this work when it is popular and when the headlines are leading, but when no one is paying attention, but we still have to plan, we still have to train, we still have to organize. Before all of our elders sat at those lunch counters and marched in the streets, they trained, they learned, they read, they built coalitions. They made sure that people of color, Jewish folks, Muslim folks, immigrants, people, LGBTQ folks, disabled people who are experiencing oppression, that we understood that we were stronger together and that we moved forward together. And we are continuing to increase that and expand those coalitions as we move forward. That's precisely the work that we have to do now so that we're not satiated by mere symbols, but that we're only satisfied with deep, real, lasting equity, justice, and change.
We've only got a couple of minutes left here, but coming to you first, Reverend Lafayette, we're at a time when people have deepening mistrust in government institutions, people who feel like their votes don't matter. What do you say to folks who don't feel a deep urge to get engaged because they just don't believe it'll make a difference?
Well, I think that that's a very important question, because that will make all the difference if they don't feel that they're making a difference. And the thing that can cause them to make a difference is to see the results of their work. Now, since we only have a few minutes left, here's what my proposal is. I'd like to see us organize a youth legislature, ages 12 to 17, have those young people create a replication of the existing legislature with their own candidates. And what they would do is have those young people be aware of what's happening in the older legislative body, and they would invite those candidates, I mean, and as well as those existing, you know, representatives, to a monthly meeting. They can call it a party, okay, youth party. But they also can give prizes and give gifts to those who turn 18, because every month you have a whole group of young folks turning 18. So they can actually vote now once they turn 18.
But in the meantime, they'd be getting informed about the issues and adding their voice to the conversation.
Exactly.
Reverend Lafayette, and that's a fantastic idea.
They pay attention to what's going on, yeah.
Well, Brittany and Jarrell, I think you've got some marching orders there. That's Bernard Lafayette Jr., longtime civil rights leader and activist. Brittany Packnett Cunningham, she's the founder of Love and Power. And also with us today, Jarrell Jordan, senior political science major at Morehouse College. He's a former White House ambassador for HBCUs. Thanks to you all for joining us today. This last message from a listener who says, education is the key to positive social change. And even as a white woman with no children, I can and must be a part of any change I want to see in the world. First, I must educate myself. Then I must speak out to family and friends, parents to kids, our teachers, and most importantly, to our leaders. And just like Lewis, I will keep speaking out until my very last breath. That's all for today. Remember, we're on Instagram. Follow us at The 1A Show. This conversation was produced by Michelle Harvin and edited by Matthew Simonson. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks so much for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.